or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Laura, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 12th issue of the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. They're trying to publish the best books you've never heard of. Hagfish is a small press focused on out-of-print and obscure books by women, but it's flexible on all of those things. By Quinn Moreland. Sunshine poured into Naomi Huffman's apartment in the Prospect Lefferts Garden neighborhood of Brooklyn on a late summer afternoon, casting a warm glow on an impressively long alphabetized bookshelf. These were ideal catnap conditions, and one fluffy feline wisely snoozed atop a box containing hats embroidered with the phrase, "Man-hating psycho." It was the name of a story collection by Iphigenia Ball, the second title from Hagfish, a small press focused on out-of-print and obscure books. Ms. Huffman and Julia Ringo started the project in 2022 as a studio offering developmental support and freelance editing services, and began acquiring books the next year. Their debut title arrived in May, To Smithereens, the 1972 novel by Rosalind Drexler, set between the worlds of art criticism and women's wrestling. Ms. Drexler died last month at 98, not long after her book received a new wave of recognition. The pair work independently. Ms. Ringo lives in Bedford-Stuyvesant, but regularly convene at Ms. Huffman's to mail galleys and exchange paperbacks. Dressed in a well-worn Grey Gardens t-shirt, Ms. Huffman, 36, poured a cup of tea for Ms. Ringo, 34, who sat on an oriental rug. They were discussing the language sometimes used to describe forgotten writers. "I really resent when something is labeled a discovery," Ms. Huffman said. "We found this in the rubble of time. It was there all along." "We're not labeling these authors as tragic cases that we're rescuing from wherever they tumbled, but women who produced creative work under sometimes challenging circumstances," Ms. Ringo added. Hagfish is far from the first publisher to focus on backlist titles. The co-founders cited New York Book Reviews, McNally Editions, and Persephone Books as inspirations. Ms. Huffman and Ms. Ringo's idea of Overlooked, however, also includes contemporary writers they believe deserve more attention. Ms. Ball's Man-Hating Psycho, for instance, which will be released in the United States this month, was first published just a few years ago in Britain. Hagfish's spring title will be In the City, the 1987 novel by the award-winning author Joan Silber. "For as much recognition as Joan has had, I think she should be as famous as Anne Patchett or Elizabeth Strout," Ms. Ringo said. They gravitate toward voices that are messy, playful, and sometimes raunchy, usually delivering unromanticized truths about loneliness, sex, and class. "So far, it's been all women," Ms. Ringo said, though she noted that Hagfish's latest agency client was a male author. "We consider this a feminist project, but that's a term we use generously." The funny thing about missions and small presses is you don't actually have to stick to them, said Martin Riker, who since 2009 has run Dorothy, an independent feminist imprint with his wife Danielle Dutton. "You do end up swerving a lot. There's a vitality to doing different kinds of books." Ms. Huffman and Ms. Ringo both began working as editors at Farrar, Strauss and Giroux in 2017. Ms. Huffman had relocated from Chicago, where she ran a small press out of her apartment. "We bonded really quickly. We had similar taste in books and ideas about what we wanted to do in our careers," Ms. Ringo said, recalling an early lunch at Westville. Ms. Huffman was impressed that Ms. Ringo had acquired her first book as an assistant editor. "She struck me as a very conscious and precise writer, even when we were just g-chatting about the Transit of Venus reissue. Naomi had the cool factor of not feeling like part of the publishing machine, Ms. Ringo said. I was energized by that outsider energy. In 2018, Ms. Huffman began exploring the archives of the author Catherine Dunn and Lewis at Lewis and Clark College. Her efforts led to the 2022 publication of Toad, a rejected novel by Ms. Dunn, who died in 2016, about the unrealized dreams of a bohemian slob in Portland, Oregon. Near Flesh, a story collection, arrives this fall via MCD Books, a division of Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Ms. Ringo was inspired by her colleague's gumption, and the pair began envisioning an imprint focused on reissues from the FSG archives, even landing on a name. FSG's colophon is three fish, and the MCD imprint uses an electric eel, Ms. Ringo said. With aquatic creatures in mind, they considered, per Ms. Huffman, the queerest, most feminist fish. Jawless and industriously slimy, the gloriously repulsive hagfish fit the bill. Looking to challenge herself, Ms. Huffman left FSG in early 2020 to work as a freelance editor. She not so subtly held out hope that Ms. Ringo would join her to pursue hagfish. The ingredients for persuasion were there, but I was definitely scared to leave, Ms. Ringo recalled. After much consideration, Ms. Ringo took the leap 2 years later. As hagfish began to take shape, the pair formed an unpaid advisory board, a group of ideal readers who offer feedback on cover designs and acquisitions. Members include the writer and artist Molly Crabapple, the music critic Jessica Hopper, and the filmmaker Sandy Tan. The co-founders also sought advice from industry figures like Simonson, the chief bookseller of Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle. He thought it was amazing that no one had ever looked into everything that Toni Morrison had ever acquired for Random House as an editor, Ms. Ringo said. They took the bait. One unfamiliar name was Nettie Jones, whose 1984 debut Fish Tales, purchased by Ms. Morrison for $3,000, had made a small splash in its time. Struck by the modernity of Ms. Jones's writing, Ms. Huffman and Ms. Ringo tried to contact her through Wayne State University, where her manuscripts are held. In the meantime, they read old reviews in digitized archives and pursued obscure connections, including former agents and the organizers of a symposium about Ms. Jones' mentor, Gail Jones. They actually looked for me, Ms. Jones, 84, said over the phone. Some folks simply said that they just couldn't find me. She had long maintained faith that her book would get a second life. These women came to my home with respect for me, she said, describing Ms. Huffman and Ms. Ringo as her angels. I believe they brought me some lovely desserts, she added. Looking for the Rolls Royce of strollers? What about an Aston Martin? Luxury options and brand collaborations abound for parents looking to project wealth and luxury while out for a walk. By Jessica Roy. In the spring of 2020, when Savannah Egan was 7 months pregnant, she came across a baby gear listing that she could not resist. Her taste had always been classic. She's a historian by trade and has a penchant for heirloom sewing and hand embroidery, and she wanted to purchase a stroller that fit that aesthetic. So when she found a woman selling a limited edition vintage Balmoral pram from the British brand Silver Cross, she knew she had to have it. Ms. Egan drove to Los Angeles from her home in San Diego and loaded the 80-pound stroller into the back of her car. She paid $900, which could be seen as a bargain since Balmoral's, one of the most exclusive and expensive strollers on the resale market, regularly retail for upward of $3,000. They call it the Rolls-Royce of strollers, and they're not kidding. It's massive. Miss Egan, who now lives in North Carolina, said in a recent phone interview, and it's definitely not user-friendly. But it's beautiful. Silver Cross Balmoral-style strollers, which have long been a favorite of the British royal family, crossed over to influencers and luxury fans in the United States with the help of social media. When the podcaster, Jackie Oshry, had a baby 2 years ago, she posted a photo of the status stroller in her living room. And on TikTok, some users frequently post videos showing off their Balmorals. Restored Balmorals are on the high end of a booming market for luxury strollers that includes offerings from the typical baby gear powerhouses, but also from collaborations with fashion houses, car companies, and more. The Balmoral is its own animal, and it is no longer manufactured by Silver Cross, meaning that interested buyers need to consult someone like Scott Frew, the manager of Prams with Pizzazz, a vintage stroller restoration business based in Britain that is owned by his wife Carolyn. The business started 10 years ago when the Frews customized a miniature Balmoral, hand-painting the hood to look like a ladybug. Since then, Mr. Frew said he had restored thousands of prams, including a six-figure family heirloom stroller for one client so private they required an NDA. Mr. Frew said that he kept a stock of about 300 in his warehouse in Scotland and that he shipped internationally, including to the United States. Prices start at around $3,300 or £2,500. But Mr. Frew said their durability made the price worth it. You get a lot more use out of them, he said. They look a lot nicer than the strollers that you get nowadays that, if you're lucky, last for one baby. For those looking for high-end options without the complications of having one restored, fashion houses like Dior and Fendi are capitalizing on the status stroller moment by collaborating with companies on their own designs. Loro Piana sells a thermoregulating stroller in a not very baby-friendly cream color for around $5,800 or 5,000 euros. Silver Cross recently partnered with Lamborghini to create a $5,500 stroller, while the British brand Egg announced last month that it was collaborating with Aston Martin on a bespoke stroller that would hit the market later this year. Cybex, a brand best known for its stylish collaborations, currently offers a 1950s nostalgia-inspired stroller designed by Jeremy Scott for $2,499.95. Rebecca Kiminanu, a baby gear expert and professional registry consultant, said that beyond imports like Silver Cross, many of the popular luxury stroller brands in the United States remain the same as they did two decades ago, when Sex and the City helped put the Bugaboo frog on the map. She often recommends a Bugaboo, like the $1,500 Kangaroo, or a Cybex, like the $2,250 E-Pram, which includes a built-in motor to make pushing uphill easier, both of which have proved to be both luxurious and durable. Ms. Kiminow added that many of her clients wanted a luxury option that could be easily converted and customized with different fabrics and accessories. The Upa Baby Vista V3, a favorite of luxury influencers like Campbell Puckett, better known as Pookie, offers more than 30 configurations, as well as extra canopy and seat fabric kits in different colors, so you can change your stroller's aesthetic anytime. Those options may be more practical than a Balmoral, no matter how classic its design is. After purchasing her Silver Cross, Ms. Egan said she had used it only once or twice. It does not fold up, and its weight makes it difficult to transport in a car. Instead, like most of her friends, she uses a Vista for her everyday stroller. But she does not regret buying the Balmoral. We ended up just kind of having it in the house, and we used it for photos and to keep my kids' stuffed animals in it. And they like to climb up in there and play with it, she said. But yeah, I just think they're beautiful. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. the word everyone in fashion can't stop using. Why is everything called archival all of a sudden? By Jacob Gallagher. It's the word that ate the fashion industry. Archive. Banana Republic has an archive collection where it sells its Reagan-era t-shirts and pants. Sydney Sweeney hasn't merely worn a Versace dress, she has worn an archival Versace dress. In Paris, you can buy 30-year-old Comme des Garçons jackets and Margiela sweaters from the archivist store. That's not to be confused with other resellers like Archive Reloaded, Archive Threads, or Archive Vintage. And new labels like Post-Archive Faction and Blarchive Trade on the hazy authority of labeling something archival to sell their ideas. It's a peculiar use of that term, said Valerie Steele, the director and chief curator of the museum at the Fashion Institute of Technology. Dr. Steele has a lot of familiarity with fashion archives in the traditional sense. Mammoth, often climate-controlled storerooms of antique garments managed by fashion houses in various states of anal-retentive organization. To her, archive is suffering the same fate as the word curation. If it once added a glaze of authority to an item, it has now been overused to the point of obsolescence. The implication is that you too could have an archive of iconic fashion, you know, historically and artistically significant fashion, Dr. Steele said. In reality, as she said, it can be a little bit confusing. It's in the vintage market where you'll encounter the term most abundantly and inconsistently. On the resale marketplace, Grailed, a $20,000 Raf Simons parka from 2005 is deemed archival by one seller. But another seller uses the term for a $49 Stussy t-shirt. Vintage sellers treat archive as the Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart once viewed obscenity. I know it when I see it. Often, it's a process of elimination. A 2010 Lincoln Park tour tee? Not archive, said Cole Reagan, who owns Archive Reloaded, a web shop based in Torrance, California. That's not even that old, Mr. Reagan said. It's not that rare, either. If this is the shirt that will complete your life, you can find one on eBay for $35 right now. Mr. Reagan also said that he has seen some online dealers claiming that anything bought from a Japanese auction site is archival. Where an item hails from, he said, does not determine its archiveness. So what does? Scott Santiago, senior manager of brand marketing at Grailed, offered that archival denotes the importance of the design or of the era that it came from. That definition seems close to reality. Wade into the vintage waters online and truisms emerge. Anything that ushered a fashion sea change, a Dior home shrunken suit or an original nylon Prada handbag from the aughts, earns the archival stamp, as does a piece from a collection that fashion group thinks dictates was unimpeachably great. See the tattoo tops from Jean-Paul Gaultier's 1995 collection, or just about anything from Martin Margiela's tenure at Hermes. Consensus, though, is flimsy. A 2001 Raf Simons camo bomber drenched in haphazard patches and worn by Drake and Ye, finally something rappers agree on, is, was, and always will be archival. One is available on Grailed for around $50,000. But would a t-shirt or a pair of pants from the same collection be archival? That, Mr. Santiago said, is in the eye of the beholder. Carrie Bonnell, the owner of Archive Vintage in Austin, Texas, offered a simpler definition. When I would say collectible design, I think people are just saying archival now. When Ms. Bonnell founded her business in 2006, the term hadn't yet washed over the vintage world. For her, it was a way to distinguish her shop, Specializing in museum-caliber luxury designs from the vast ocean of vintage sellers peddling stale suits and costumey dresses. See, a skeleton-printed $6,800 Alexander McQueen mini dress from 2009. Back then, vintage sites were dusty, with wicker mannequins and pink backgrounds and lots of hats and gloves like grandma stuff, she said. Resellers today are coming to Ms. Bonnell's conclusion over and over again. Archive is just shorthand for better than mere vintage. Sticking the word in a listing will tell the right buyer where to look, Mr. Santiago said. In practice, though, that means the word is used, and really abused, by advantageous resellers. It's just trying to keep ahead of the algorithm, Mr. Reagan said. Grailed, for example, does not police what words sellers use in their listings, and resellers are free to describe items however they wish. The upshot? There are currently more than 38,000 listings with the term on Grailed. If the term is elastic, it is perhaps nearing a breaking point. Just because something is really niche and maybe special doesn't mean that it actually matters or it's actually valuable, said Luke Fratcher, the owner of Luke's, a clothing reseller in New York and Los Angeles. He finds himself in the camp that believes the term has been overused to the point that it no longer has any authority at all. It's such a fluid, dynamic term that it means nothing, he said. And calling something archival doesn't automatically make an item easier to sell. And Hermes' dress from 1999 may be covetable and also archival to certain collectors, but do they have $3,090 to buy one off eBay right now? Not quite. The more niche something is, the harder it is to actually sell, Mr. Fratcher said. Even if the term is overused, the archive onslaught exposes how shoppers today are hungry for something different, something scarce, something plainly rare. Any rich guy can go into, like, Louis Vuitton and spend $100,000 to $300,000 and walk out looking just like a monogram, Mr. Reagan said. Yet buying a Louis Vuitton jacket from 20 years ago? That demonstrates, if not deeper fashion knowledge, then at least some crafty shopping skills. It can look a lot more cultured than just being a rich kid, he said. Indeed, if shoppers are spelunking around in the back catalogs of designer brands, it's because new luxury fashion has become too accessible and too obvious. When Hailey Bieber dusts off a pinstripe suit from Thierry Mulger's 1998 collection, she's saying, "I got this, and you can't have it." And when you buy a Kenzo bubble dress from Ms. Bonnell dating back to 1977, you're practically guaranteeing that you'll never run into anyone in the same design. That exclusivity will cost $2,150 to be exact. Lauren Greenfield on the sad, dark kingdom of the rich, the Broadway adaptation of her 2012 documentary, The Queen of Versailles, highlights the financial lessons people refuse to learn. By Gina Belafonte. In 2007, the photographer Lauren Greenfield was sent by Elle magazine to shoot the opening of a Versace store in Beverly Hills. A trio of women who had come together quickly caught her attention, each carrying a variation of a gold lamé Versace handbag. The resulting image? A shot of them from the neck down, beaming in on the leather and fur, the big rings, and body-skimming dresses, acquired an unforeseen longevity, appearing in other magazines and eventually in museum exhibits of Ms. Greenfield's work as a symbol of the latest unsettling chapter in gilded American prosperity. One of the women in the picture was Jackie Siegel, the wife of much older Florida real estate impresario, with whom she shared seven children, a plane, and an initiative to build the largest house in the country, on the outskirts of Disney World. At the time, she was one of Versace's biggest clients, and Ms. Greenfield was among the art world's most admired portraitists of wealth in overdrive and the disparities it was powering. So in 2009, finding herself in Florida on assignment, this time to photograph the wives of white-collar criminals, Miss Greenfield remembered Ms. Siegel and got in touch. What followed was an extended immersion with her family, culminating in the improbably sympathetic 2012 documentary, The Queen of Versailles, which has evolved, perhaps less predictably, into a new Broadway musical starring Kristen Chenoweth. It arrives at a moment when pride in outsized expenditure has been normalized in so many quarters, when, as Miss Greenfield said during a recent visit to New York, we have gotten farther and farther away from the value of modesty. She had flown in from Los Angeles, where she lives, to attend rehearsals for the show and a packed screening and subsequent conversation about the originating artifact. What is striking about the film so many years later is the deft way it telegraphs both compassion and quiet admonition. Miss Greenfield doesn't hate the player, but she hates the game, having rejected whatever temptation might have existed to cast her subject's hunger as crude, soulless venality. For a short while, Miss Greenfield thought that her film might work as an opera. The pathos and melodrama were all there, the emotional highs and lows of a material ambition born of a certain adolescent longing. Miss Siegel grew up in a small town in upstate New York, the daughter of a night shift worker, and came of age in the Reagan 80s, when much of the country seemed to be barreling toward big money, while many others were stuck where they began. As the years passed, Ms. Greenfield became consumed with other projects, the most recent of them the 5-part Hulu documentary Social Studies, which looked at the algorithmic spelled TikTok and other platforms cast on a group of high schoolers as they emerged from the pandemic. It was also during COVID when she got a call from Bill Damaschek, who produced Moulin Rouge on Broadway. He wanted to turn The Queen of Versailles into a musical, an idea that Miss Greenfield's husband, Frank Evers, had also batted around. It was not immediately clear how a frothy staging might bear the weight of the film's arguments. The allegory, the morality tale, the combination of comedy and tragedy, the architectural expression of success and failure. It had all the elements, Miss Greenfield said. My concern was that any adaptation would have to contain the same critique as the film. A change in the Siegel's fortunes risked the possibility that it would not. The American musical has long functioned as a genre to warm to stories of hardy bounders, whether they are hustling to make it in show business, Singing in the Rain, or establish freedom from the imperial control, Hamilton. But the documentary ends with the Siegel's own monarchical dream flattened by the 2008 financial crisis, which forces them into foreclosure a few years later. The couple eventually rebounds, though, getting back their house. The fact that they got rich again, that they went back to this Sisyphean project that is still not finished, Miss Greenfield said, meant we had to come to terms with the fact that they didn't learn, that we as a culture didn't learn. After the crisis receded, the old values returned, she observed. The overspending and the showiness about it that was now amplified by social media and a political ruling class that embraced ostentation. Ms. Greenfield and her husband are co-producers of the musical. She has been an advisor since the beginning, a great lighthouse, as the show's director, Michael Arden, put it. The result has pleased her, the resistance of a pull toward derision. As an artist, her goal has been to humanize aspiration, to reflect back on her audience that a collective addiction to more, whether the more is an impossibly huge house or an Audi over a Kia or Stanford over Michigan State, binds us in a shared pain, feelings of inadequacy when we cannot get what we want, and an emptiness when we do. The musical is in many ways more damning than the film, ending with Jackie staring into a ring light by herself in her gigantic house, posting to social media. There is a kind of world building going on with the Versailles house, Miss Greenfield said. And there is so many, as there are in so many gated communities, where the rich seclude themselves. The Siegel house has 11 kitchens, a bowling alley, 6 pools. You never have to leave. The other side of that is that you are alone. That's what the end of the musical really leans into. And I think what Jackie is really thinking about now. Ms. Greenfield's style, absent the swish and bling of her subjects, is largely unremarkable. She had a canvas tote bag, of the kind you would stuff with farmer's market produce, a bag stamped with the Louis Vuitton logo, which she seemed to carry both as concession and commentary. When her children were little, she said, they asked why she didn't carry designer bags like the other moms. I've always had the desire, she said, talking about her relationship to affluence and all the accompanying paraphernalia, and check on the desire. Her work over the past 30 years has largely been concerned with exploring the worlds of those who do not. Ms. Greenfield saw something familiar in Miss Siegel early on, even in her own experience. Growing up on the west side of Los Angeles, the child of 2 Harvard-educated academics was markedly different. Her father's trajectory from a working-class upbringing in Cincinnati to a prominent career in medicine and public health left a lasting impression on her worldview. So did her experience as a student at Crossroads, the progressive private school in Santa Monica. Once, at an event there, Dr. Greenfield was asked what he did for a living, his daughter recalled. He said he was a professor, and the other parent said, "Oh, then you must not make very much money." When Miss Greenfield had her own children, 2 boys, now 25 and 19, she sent them to Crossroads as well. Years ago, her older son sent her a video from a bar mitzvah he was attending, one where a funhouse blower spewed out cash that children were sent scrambling for, permitted to keep whatever they caught. Sometime later in 2018, Ms. Greenfield released another documentary, Generation Wealth, which was preceded by a companion monograph spanning more than 500 pages, looking at ostentation across demographics. In the world of child beauty pageants, oligarchs, rappers, hedge fund managers, and ordinary teenagers. What troubles her is that so many teenagers were then, and remain even more so now, angling not to be, but rather to acquire. Kids want to be rich and famous, she said, and that is not a job. One image in Generation Wealth has a boy, Emmanuel, sitting in his modest bedroom with open Cartier boxes spread around him. He is identified as a student at Harvard Westlake, the toniest LA private school, someone who beseeches his parents to buy him things they cannot afford. It's easy to lie about money, he says, as long as you don't invite people to your house. Since the 1950s, the average size of the American home has more than doubled, even as family size has shrunk. Still, according to a 2024 study by the National Association of Home Builders, just 6% of home buyers want to live in houses that are more than 4,000 square feet. Yet that is hardly the notion you would be left with if you lived anywhere near Bel Air or Greenwich or certain parts of Houston or Atlanta, or if your aperture into the country's domestic experience came to you mostly via Instagram. Buying a house, owning a home, used to be connected to community and good deeds, to stability, to giving your children a better future, to making the country a better place, Ms. Greenfield said. But the values it was expressing have gone away. The external manifestation of what you want to show off is all that matters now. And size often matters most. The house we're in now, although it's sweet, Miss Chenoweth sings as Jackie, is only like 26,000 square feet. The new Siegel House is 90,000 square feet. When Ms. Greenfield's documentary came out 13 years ago, it would have been hard to envision, to borrow real estate argo, a comp. What did 90,000 square feet look like? Was it the size of an airline hangar? Now, as it turns out, there is an easy referent. 90,000 square feet, as Ms. Greenfield pointed out, speaking about the White House toward the end of our conversation, is exactly the size of Trump's new ballroom. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Style section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Is going viral dead? Spontaneous original content shared by people all over the world made the internet a fun place to be. It's more complicated now. By Madison Malone Kircher. In May 2016, Candace Payne, a stay-at-home mother from Texas, walked into a Kohl's department store to return some yoga pants and made a purchase that would change her life. It was a plastic Chewbacca mask that made noises like the beloved furry Star Wars character. Ms. Payne streamed a video on Facebook Live, then a new feature being pushed by the tech platform to encourage users to share in real time. Seated in her car in the store's parking lot, Ms. Payne giggled in a manner best described as a physical embodiment of as a coffee mug mantra, laugh like nobody is watching. Except people were watching. Lots of them. It was an instance of internet monoculture. A few days when it felt like everyone on social media was keyed into the same thing. A decade ago, that was not exactly a rare occurrence. Once Chewbacca Mom, as she quickly became known, exited the stage, in would come a parade of others who briefly became main characters and earned the Homeric epithets that long outlasted their turn in the spotlight. The BBC dad, cinnamon toast shrimp guy. Going viral online often involved ordinary people stumbling into transcendence. It held the potential to change your life. It could give a small business an enormous boost overnight. It could land you on a walk-on spot on the Ellen DeGeneres show, and a comically oversized check from that day's corporate sponsor. You could become the face, briefly, of Ocean Spray, and give a rock song from the 1970s its biggest streaming week to date. These mass attention-getting events had nothing to do with the world leaders or extreme weather or tragedy or Hollywood celebrities. They were low stakes, but they became a global pastime. During the rise of Facebook as a kind of universal platform, and now this feels Neolithic, there were these moments of really universal instant global culture, said Ben Smith, the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Semaphore. With the rise of algorithmically driven social media platforms like TikTok, moments that get people around the world talking on cable news and at the dinner table are becoming less common. Each user's feed is hyper-tailored to them, meaning no one sees the same version of the internet. Content creation can now be a full-time job, and as most creators jockey for fame and influence, piggybacking off trending topics and buzzwords to game the system, it's become far easier for the average person to find hundreds of thousands of followers or even millions of views. There's such a saturation on social media that we did not have back in the time of 2016, said Ms. Payne of Chewbacca mask fame. You could throw a rock at a teenager and hit one that's had a viral video from TikTok nowadays. But if everyone is going viral, that means no one is. It was February 27, 2015, when seemingly the entire internet was engaged in a raucous, low-stakes debate about a striped dress. Was it blue and black, or was it white and gold? The grainy image of the dress had been resurfaced by BuzzFeed, then a nascent media company that had staffed a newsroom with reporters whose remit was relatively novel at the time. These media workers chronicled what was happening across the internet, hunting for some nugget, a meme, a video starting to pick up traction, like a post about a sad grandpa who threw a picnic for his family but only one person bothered to show up, that might move viewers to extreme feelings. This online world, still quite separate from real life, had its own gossip and intrigue, providing diversions for a certain generation of office workers, refreshing new media websites like Gawker, HuffPost, and BuzzFeed. Virality was not a natural result of the internet, said Rusty Foster, who since 2013 has written the Daily Media and Internet Culture newsletter in Today in Tabs. It was an outgrowth of a particular media ecosystem that existed at a time and doesn't exist anymore. Would-be viral stars needed these digital news outlets as much as the outlets needed them. These same outlets had the power to generate viral moments of their own, like the time BuzzFeed got hundreds of thousands of people to tune into Facebook to watch as employees placed rubber bands around a watermelon until it exploded. As with the dress, many of these flashpoints generated friendly online sparring. But as harmless as the discussions might have been, they were still fundamentally divisive, Mr. Smith said, and would come to help shape the way platforms operate today. The reason it spread so fast was because people were arguing, said Mr. Smith, the one-time editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. The negative attention, he added, made some platforms wary. He recalled Jonah Peretti, BuzzFeed's co-founder and chief executive, meeting with a senior Facebook employee after the dress went viral. Mr. Peretti was excited. The Facebook staffer, however, was alarmed. The dress, lighthearted as it might have been, was still a moment in which large swaths of the internet were getting into drag-out fights with one another. It was not hard, Mr. Smith said, to imagine such debates taking a more frightening turn. Not long after the dress and the watermelon, a new app called Musical.ly, Musical.ly, burst onto the scene, popular with teenagers in the United States. At first, it generated its own versions of viral moments, a dance that hundreds of thousands of people would replicate, the tale of a woman who traded a bobby pin for a house over the course of nearly 2 years, a recipe for a delicious pasta dish. As the app, now known as TikTok, grew more popular, its users slowly acclimated to its proprietary algorithm, which at times seemed to know them better than they knew themselves. By August 2018, TikTok had surpassed Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, and YouTube in monthly downloads. And to keep up in the race for the users' attention spans, other platforms soon embraced an algorithmically driven approach to surfacing content. In 2016, Instagram began to test non-chronological feed, initially too much grousing. But later, a study backed by Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook, found that many people preferred the algorithmic experience. A time-based feed left them bored and likely to jump ship to scroll on another platform. That meant internet users could no longer dip into a stream of continuous linear conversation. Without chronology, life on the internet became more fractured and it became rarer for people to be talking about the same thing at the same time. There's been this sea of change from content that is shared by people in your networks to this automatic feed of content based on your own interests, said Caitlin Dewey, who writes the Substack newsletters, Links I Would G-Chat You If We Were Friends. Anything that could fairly be called a viral moment, she continued, just sort of dissolves and dissipates across many billions of people's highly individualized feeds. To keep users engaged, those same strong emotions that helped shape early viral content had to become more extreme, meaning that much of the content that captures widespread attention features belligerent people being yanked off airplanes or screaming at fellow drivers in parking lots. To go truly, universally viral lately is almost always to be having a particularly bad day, like this summer when a married tech executive was spotted with a female colleague looking very cozy on the Jumbotron at a Coldplay concert. Either they're having an affair, or they're just very shy, Chris Martin, the band's frontman, joked on stage as the couple tried to skirt off frame. It was too late, though, and by morning their names, faces, and personal details were everywhere, from social media to mainstream media outlets, including this one. Astronomer, the company where they worked, put out an ad shortly after to capitalize and redirect the attention. It starred Gwyneth Paltrow, Mr. Martin's ex-wife. Behind the joke was a chilling reminder that, with cameras always rolling, anyone could be the star of the next Coldplay gate. Ms. Payne, or Chewbacca Mom, continues to enjoy the spoils of her brief moment in the spotlight. She still lives in Texas, but has since carved out a multifaceted career as a writer, podcaster, speaker, and self-described joy evangelist. In an online store, she sells $25 motivational journals and $5 keychains full of emergency confetti. She said she did not regret the course her life took. Still, Ms. Payne was wary of anyone else looking to purposefully trace the same path. As I look back, she said, I would hope that nobody would really want to be viral. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Styles section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Modern Love, Negotiating the End of Us. My husband kept saying he was going to die at a young age, but we could never agree on an acceptable number. By Leslie Blanchard. He always told me he was going to die young. We used to argue about it. I realize now how comical that sounds. Not the dying part, obviously. Just the arguing about it. What do you mean by young, I would say. Define young. The most recent time we had this conversation, Jimmy tried to come across casually, as though we were discussing the weather. Oh, hell, I don't know, he said. Maybe 60? 60? I shrieked. And then the bargaining commenced, as he attempted to calm me down by tossing out what he surmised might be a more palatable number. Okay, 65, he said. 5 more years, I said. You're giving me 5 more years. We have cottage cheese in our refrigerator older than that. The faster I circled the drain, the more conciliatory he became. How am I supposed to know, he said. It's not like I have a crystal ball. Well, I mean, it sounds like you have a crystal ball, I said. You're the one that brought this up, after all. And with that elusive upper hand, I continued haggling. I could maybe agree to 75, but that's as low as I can go. We bandied hypothetical ages back and forth, as if this was an exercise in arbitration, a minor marital tiff, like whether we would have Thai for dinner. These conversations never failed to trigger me. I had built my world around him, and he was proffering some casual heads up that he may be dismantling it way sooner than planned. As futile as it was, we continued to negotiate on a number with which we could both live. Or one I could live with, and Jimmy could die with, I suppose. And it's not as though he wanted to die. Of this I'm certain. We've buried years upon years of memories, one on top of the other, like sacred marital catacombs layered along the way. I meander around through these cherished vignettes whenever I need to reassure myself. One of those cherished memories was when we both turned 50 and our friends threw us a celebratory bash in our own home. Later that evening, after kicking everyone out, we stood together at the sink washing wine glasses, trading snippets of hilarity from the evening and enjoying our mutual playlist. When one of my songs, Phil Collins, A Groovy Kind of Love, started playing, he took the dish towel from my hand and led me out to our makeshift dance floor between our island and kitchen table. But it wasn't the memory of kitchen dancing that seared into my brain. It was when I looked up to see tears streaming down his face. It seemed we had entered our last decade together, and he had started to mourn the loss of us. A few years later, I was lounging on the couch on a Sunday afternoon, scrolling mindlessly through social media, when the doorbell rang. I'm not sure how I didn't hear it. I was much closer to the front door than our youngest son, Tommy, but regrettably, he heard the doorbell first. When Tommy walked into the den, he said, "Mom, there's a police officer at the door holding Dad's cell phone and wallet." All I remember thinking was, here it is, just like he said. Here is the end of us. The officer told me Jimmy was killed by a distracted driver. He was 54. It took a few weeks for it to hit me. Why hadn't I accepted his generous offer of 65 back when I had the chance? I never was adept at bargaining. Many years earlier, we were carefree college students. He was an intense and ambitious business major, and I was dabbling in the humanities. My philosophy professor assigned our class what I naively thought was the most difficult assignment ever given. We were to write a paper that juxtaposed the concept of predestination against the concept of human free will. I spent days constructing my argument in my mind before I put pen to paper. Part of my creative writing process involved whining to him about it. How do I juxtapose two concepts that are so diametrically opposed? He laughed and said, "Just BS your way through it. You'll do fine." I suppose that's what I did. But to this day, I can't remember a word I wrote, just that I got an A. Nonetheless, the mental rigor of that assignment never really left my consciousness. The time for me to write that paper was after he died, when the creative floodgates opened, leading me to ponder how much control we actually have over life's outcomes. When I immerse myself in these lofty thoughts, I'm reminded of that scene from Sleeping Beauty, when the king is warned the princess will die on her 16th birthday after she pricks her finger on a spinning wheel. In an effort to control the destiny of one he loves, he issues a decree, "Burn all the spinning wheels." But in the end, she manages to prick her finger anyway. The lesson I take from this is that there's only so much you can control in life, even when you fancy you're in charge of your entire kingdom. And I try to draw succor from that. When I met Jimmy, we were both 18. He arrived with a swagger, a leather jacket, and a motorcycle, the perfect accessory package for our stage life. Years later, after we were engaged and planning our wedding, daring to speak of future children, I knew my groom needed a makeover. A four-door sedan and a briefcase would fit neatly into the new era I envisioned a little more, the family man and a little less rebel without a cause. As luck would have it, his motorcycle was stolen when he was working at a restaurant in Houston a few months before the wedding. It was the first time I saw him cry. "They stole my effing bike," he said. "You don't need a motorcycle," I said. "We're about to get married and have children. Motorcycles are too dangerous. We don't want our kids growing up around them." I quoted a statistic or two. Things fell neatly into place when he purchased his grandmother's old Plymouth Volare. I'll never forget the first time he pulled into my parents' driveway in that beast. He was still cool. His coolness was intrinsic to his persona and didn't rely on his mode of transportation. Nonetheless, the feeling I had that day is the way I imagine ranchers must feel when they break a prize stallion. The stallion may still be a masterful creature, but you know you've chiseled out a piece of his soul. That must be why I didn't intervene more aggressively in what transpired 30 years later when he approached me with a big grin, thrust his laptop at me and said, "Look what I found on Craigslist." He had found his stolen bike. Or a bike that happened to be the same year, make, model, and color with the same custom pinstriping. "I always promised myself if I ever became successful," he said, "I'd buy my bike back." Of course I attempted to discourage him, straight out of the Good Wife Handbook, but I also couldn't deny how unselfishly he had worked to provide a life for me and our children, never indulging himself with pastimes or hobbies. Per my plan, he had morphed into the epitome of a family man. I didn't feel like there was much I could say to dissuade him. After all, the youngest of our brood was packing for college. He bought the bike, promising he would never ride on the interstate without a helmet or at night. True to his word, he was killed in broad daylight on a country road behind our house. Strangers who witnessed him dying on the side of the road confirmed that his helmet was securely fastened. The distracted driver, who took his life, had no driver's license, no insurance, and seemingly no remorse. I find myself mulling over that college philosophy assignment and those two naive young kids who thought a little BS would get us through anything. I know better now. As a widow with lived experience, I'm more invested these days in the truth the professor was getting at as opposed to the grade I sought. Do we have free will? Can we make choices that will change the future? Yes, of course we can and do. But we are also hurtling forward along some unalterable path over which we have little say. All I know is there is vulnerability in loving another person with all your heart and soul, in building your life around someone else. And that is often so much more than we bargained for. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 12th issue of the New York Times Style section. Your reader has been Laura. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock, we have the start of a new book. It's episode number 1 of Jack Weber Here by Jack Weber. Stay with us for these readings and more. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, broadcasting daily readings, 24 hours a day, of newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Radio Reading's broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio Reading Studios are at 1199 Harlem Road in Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Radio Reading's website is nfradioreading.org. For more information on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, call us at 716-821-5555.
Niagara